This is Weekend Let's Hear It. I'm Kara Lawrence. Thanks for tuning in. Today I'm with Monica Washington Padula, who holds a master's degree in piano performance and music theory from Western Michigan University, and Dr. Romeo Phillips, professor emeritus of Kalamazoo College. On Saturday, Ms. Washington Padula will bring together a number of prominent musicians and speakers for a free event titled The Reason Why We Sing, a lecture recital advocating for the recognition and inclusion of Black American sacred music. It's set for 2 p.m. at Portage United Church of Christ, where Monica is the organist and keyboardist. Monica and Romeo, thank you for joining me here in the studio.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
So we are going to explore some of the themes and history of Black American sacred music. But Monica, I wondered if we could begin with your story and your appreciation of this tradition. Does it go back to childhood? When did you begin to treat this special music as something you wanted to advocate for?
Absolutely. Thank you for asking that. So I do think that the introduction to having a lifelong education about Black sacred music does begin in the Black church and with the Black church experience. I have found personally that growing up with the spirituals, the hymns that are shared interdenominationally, but that were also included in the Black worship experience, and gospel music, those were all incorporated into the service. And so to me, it was the conjoined experience that I grew up with. Everything was included. And so I found that there was an emotional connection, observing the other folks in the congregation with me, observing how it felt to be a part of the church band, and observing the impact of the music on all of us. That was something that stayed with me, that I have associations with in my memories when certain songs come up. I say, oh, we used to sing this. I remember this. And there's an emotion that's connected to that piece and to those words. And so with this emotional connection, I realized that for myself, and I am sure for others, that Black American sacred music is used as prayer, as being able to have an identification of experience with what's being discussed in the song. It's used for storytelling. And it's an acceptable way, speaking about being in religious spaces, to enjoy rhythm and blues that also reflects Christian doctrine. Now, I might get some flack about that from my colleague here, but it was a way to feel that we were able to connect with actual instrumental and rhythmic music along with worshiping God.
Monica, where was this?
I actually grew up with a Seventh-day Adventist denominational background in Lansing, Michigan.
In Lansing.
That's where I'm from.
Music, clearly just one of your favorite things since you started.
Well, I majored in it because that's what I did. In my childhood, I took piano lessons, and I studied with the amazing Miss Verna Holly, and she will be featured in the program with the group that she directed for many years and now serves as accompanist, the Earl Nelson Singers. And Miss Holly, you know, taught in a classical way where we learned to read and we used the method books. And here and there, I found some connection with some of the blues pieces that I would find that were written for, you know, the level that I was at. And I would be excited to play those because they weren't part of the religious experience, but they were part of my piano lesson. So I could do both. And I really enjoyed that.
You became a very well-rounded musician.
I would agree.
With formal training and studying at the master's level at university. So today, you're a woman of many talents and trades, including teaching, I understand.
I do teach. I teach piano. I have a piano studio. And I'm also, through my advocacy for community work for both the Black and Native American communities, I end up teaching also. And so my favorite thing to do is when I can use music as a teaching tool, and it definitely elevates our experience in being able to connect to a song and understand what the authors or the storytellers are saying. And so I think it's a good way to kind of reach people that may be unreachable just by having a talking experience.
You came to school here from Lansing. When did you become acquainted with Dr. Phillips. I mean, your interests would certainly intersect. So,
well, what I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Phillips, you have a better memory than I do, is that I was invited to accompany a program that was George Gershwin music. And Dr. Phillips was holding it at his church and had invited another very prominent black vocalist. And so I got to work with, and her name is Alphalyn Roberts. So I got to work with the two of them in accompanying a ton of George Gershwin music. I played a little Gershwin in college, but it was only instrumental. It was like his three preludes. And so to be able to play some of his things from theater and some of his other styles of music was fun for me. And from then on, we clearly managed to keep in touch, but that's been almost 10 years now.
Does that fit with your memory?
Yes, it does. Let me share something with you that perhaps most people in this area don't know. I started out as a trumpet player for 25 years. I'm from the city of Chicago. And I got interested in vocal music because the black colleges would always come on tours every year during the spring. It was a recruitment thing, and I would go and listen to them. And that's when I really became interested in the sacred music of black America. And then, of course, now I'm old enough to remember my great-grandmother, who was enslaved on the plantation in the state of Mississippi. I remember sitting at her feet and talking to her, because children always catered to grandparents, but she was my great-grandmother. And she shared with me some of the stories, and she used to say that we worked from kin to kaint. Let me translate. From the time they could see the sun to the time they could not see the sun. And the traditional spirituals, I heard and became really acquainted with them from the black colleges that came. Then there was an organization in Chicago called the Umbrian Glee Club, all male. And we did that. And then, of course, I was Wings Over Jordan. This was an organization that sang on CBS radio. And the only organization that performed longer than them was the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And my late colleague, Clarence Small, sang with them. He graduated from Kalamazoo Central High School in 1942 and joined them as a boy. Eleanor Roosevelt made it possible for them to get a deferment for a period of time. But the war got so intense, and he had to go with them, and he came back. He joined Wings Over Jordan. When I joined the faculty at Kalamazoo College in 1968, we organized a group called the Afro-American Chorale. In the meantime, I had joined the National Association of Negro Musicians, which was founded in my hometown of Chicago in 1919. The primary purpose was to preserve the traditional spirituals and highlight the music of black composers and arrangers.
I was beginning to wonder about this tradition of music, black American sacred music. I thought it wasn't going anywhere. I didn't realize that it was something that needed attention, protection, resources.
Well, ironically, the National Association of Negro Musicians, we called it NAM, just celebrated our 100th anniversary in Chicago, where we were founded. And we have, you name it, instrumentalists as well as singers have belonged to that organization. In fact, William Warfield was the president at one time. And then, of course, they offered many, many scholarships to get many of these young people started, like Leontine Price. You've heard of her?
Of course.
So, and others, Martina Arroyo, conductors. In fact, even the gentleman who was the first one to receive a Pulitzer Prize for music, he is a member of the National Association of Negro Musicians.
So the fact that I am familiar with this music is thanks to people like you and people who came before you who cared so much about this music that they took extra steps to make sure it stayed in the public eye.
I have some notes to add to that. You mentioned that you felt that the music itself was secure and that it wasn't endangered or needed protecting. And I have two things about that, a little bit about the history. I'm holding right here a song that, a book that Dr. Phillips brought along to show me, and it's entitled Slave Songs of the United States, the Classic 1867 Anthology. And here I see that it's edited by three individuals. I recently just watched on YouTube an old rerun of a PBS special that talked about this book, and it talked about the history of, the folks that put this together. And I learned that the editors to the book were actually white abolitionists who understood how important it was to preserve this music, because after the emancipation, there was a generation of formerly enslaved folks, and I've read this written down, that they were in some ways ready to retire from the older work songs and from the spirituals because it reminded them of their time on the plantation and all of the oppression that they went through. And to them, it became stigmatized. So it became associated with something to be ashamed of. And they wanted to work to be able to be seen in a more dignified and classified way. And so I can understand that. And so one thing that I've been reading, I have another anthology here that was written by James Weldon Johnson and his brother, J. Rosamond Johnson. And in that introduction, Mr. Johnson talks about how these songs could have very well been lost if it had not have been for some individuals that could notate music and melody and could write them down and put them together in small anthologies, because it may not have persisted very well past some of the first generations of newly emancipated former slaves. Now, as far as why would it need protecting today, I really, really, really believe that if we look around at our institutions, starting with the elementary schools, going into high schools, looking at the music departments and all of our higher ed institutions and our colleges, where are we teaching this music? Where are we intentionally creating classes so that all individuals can learn about this music? Where are we creating programs or lectures or concerts that focus on Black American sacred songs? Why is that not obvious or intentional? And I think on a deeper level, when you think about how important representation is, when we exclude certain cultures or certain facets of culture from being seen as normal or being normalized in our programs and departments, then there could be concluded from that something about them isn't as adequate, that it's still inferior. And so what I think is that when students aren't able to see themselves reflected and represented in the departments and in the music that's being shown as the best way to learn or the best art forms to learn, I think that definitely sends a message. And it keeps students of color, including African-American students, from feeling that they can be comfortable, confident, and successful in their departments and programs because of some of the bias and the prejudice that still exists associated with these songs. And I think it's so important to present the music as something that is like formerly associated, not something to be ashamed of, and not something by which we should feel inferior, but something that we should be proud that we have been able to hold on to through such a long period of oppression, and something that we can be proud that we've maintained and that we still receive affirmation, encouragement, and the ability to express our emotions from a religious view, our praise. We can still use these songs and the ways that we perform music in a contemporary way to express these things. And so that's why I have tried to bring some of us together in a space so that we can perform and express this music in a way that is authentic to us and in a way that has meaning to us, to show that it's not for entertainment. It's to advocate for the preservation of something that really carries the souls of Black folks in it. And I really believe that.
Let me add two things to that. Many of the folk, once they became educated, they were told that they should set aside this, particularly because of the speech patterns. But remember, to the African, English was a foreign language. Then in the United States, if a person begins to speak, you can also basically tell from what part of the country that individual came. New England, the South, et cetera, et cetera. Now, to preserve something in a language, and I'm thinking about some of my colleagues at Kay, who are the linguists, they are concerned that you get the proper accent. We had a Spanish professor there who said that they were, that she spoke Spanish properly because she was from Costa Rica. Now, I had some fun one time, but we had a student who did his study in France, in Spain. And this particular secretary was from Colombia, not Colombia, Colombia. And you heard of Flip Wilson and his expression, the devil made me do this. Mm-hmm. So I came to the a young woman from Colombia. I said, what is the Spanish word for exercise? She said, ejercicio. Asked the young man from Spain, which is proper. He said, ejercicio. I said, which is correct? And he said, well, the king of Spain set the standard. And the secretary said that he spoke with a lisp. And then in German, there's Hochdeutsch, Süddeutsch, Mitteldeutsch, and Schwäbisch-Deutsch, and Alterdeutsch. And even sometimes they cannot understand each other. So, but the National Association of Negro Musicians, we want to preserve the traditional spirituals with the inflections of the speech. Now, people talk about black speech patterns. Well, we grew up in a household and we learned the language from the way our parents and other relatives spoke it and speak it. So it's very important that when we talk about this and teach it to students, let them know that English to the enslaved African was a foreign language. And it was also against the law to educate them, wanted to keep them illiterate. But the fact that they were illiterate doesn't mean that they were ignorant. And I will be talking about the music of the Underground Railroad going back to 1619, some 400 years ago.
We are currently having a preview of an event called The Reason Why We Sing, a free lecture recital advocating for the recognition and inclusion of Black American sacred music. It will be Saturday at 2 o'clock at Portage United Church of Christ. And in the studio with me are Monica Washington Padula and Dr. Romeo Phillips. And if I could keep following up with you, Dr. Phillips, I have known you to advocate for young people who want to pursue musical studies and give your time to musical causes that both educate and bring people together. What is it you want people to learn about Black American sacred music that they might not have known coming into this event?
The word is American. As I go out of the country, people said, you are American. They don't say African first. Now, I trace my ancestry back to Sierra Leone and the Mende community. I can speak some phrases in Mende, but they said, yes, you are of African ancestry, but you are American. And this is what I emphasized to my young people when I was teaching, that we in this country are unique. You name the nation, and we have representatives here.
Since we have you in our performance studio here at WMUK, I believe you are prepared to give us some samples of what we might hear at this concert. It'd be nice to include both of you in this first performance. I believe, Dr. Phillips, you're going to sing, and Monica, you'll be at the piano. Would you please tell us about this song, I'm Going to Tell God All of My Troubles?
Well, the traditional spirituals are divided into three sections. The first were worship, because the plantation owners used to gather enslaved Africans on Sunday afternoon, and they would read from a book, which we now know was the King James Version of the Bible. So that's where the religious element came. Second, for emotional support, there were no psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, et cetera, et cetera. So the songs help people adjust to the reality. And third, signals for escape. That's when I said they were illiterate but not ignorant. So I will be singing an excerpt from one particular song when an individual had been whipped and he did not feel sorry for himself, but he knew that that was a power greater than the plantation owners. Now, you know, I never used the term master because no one was a master. They were plantation owners. So the particular excerpt I'm going to do is an arrangement by Hall Johnson. I'm going to tell God all of my troubles when I get home.
This is Weekend, Let's Hear It. We're going to hear a portion now of a spiritual performed by Dr. Romeo Phillips and Monica Washington Padula.
I'm gonna tell God all of my troubles when I get home. I'm gonna tell God all of my troubles when I get home. I'm gonna tell him about my trials, all my hardships, my self-denials. I'm gonna tell God all of my troubles when I get home.
Dr. Phillips, I assume that on Saturday, you'll be singing the full song.
You know? That is correct.
That was just amazing, both of you. Such feeling, and I know you're 91, and what a beautiful voice you still have. You know.
Thank you.
I like to say that, you know, we are blessed to continue to learn history and continue to hear Dr. Phillips' interpretation, you know, of the spirituals as he has learned and learned to preserve it. I think it's a blessing, you know, that the Creator saw fit to allow Dr. Phillips to be here so that we could continue to learn. So I feel very fortunate.
Well, why don't we talk a little about some of the other guest artists on Saturday? They include some very prominent, wonderful musicians. I'll let you introduce some of them.
Yeah, so I am very excited. I actually haven't had the chance to work with everyone, so this will be an opportunity for me to work with everyone. Knowing that we have so much interest in the same music, it's so important to me. I know that Carmen Bell and Rufus Ferguson, they recently have done at least one or two events where they focused on sacred song. I think one of their titles of their events was Down by the Riverside. And so it was when I was putting this program together that I noticed that they were doing some of this work. And I said, well, let's come on together and let's do more, you know. And so I'm very excited to be working with them.
Carmen is a singer.
And she is.
And
yes.
I know Rufus Ferguson is a jazz pianist.
Yes. And also a fellow graduate. I believe in both the classical and jazz departments of that he studied both at Western. So he has both of those skills as well. One quick thing about that, when Dr. Phillips was discussing about literacy, you know, historically, not only did we not read printed work or printed literature, but I realized that part of the skill of playing by ear comes from that tradition of listening to the music orally and being able to pass that along. And so that has kept, I think, a lot of our styles of music alive, thriving, creative, and fresh, especially in the Black church. And so I think that jazz was one of those predecessors to the gospel music that we have today. Our sacred music has been so influenced by our secular music. It's the same people would go from the church and they would go into the clubs in the evening and play and enjoy themselves and be entertainers. And so that music went wherever we went.
So it's like a chicken and an egg scenario with the kinds.
Perhaps, except that in the very beginning, I think that we had more access to trying to maintain or learn about this new religion that was presented to us. And so I think most of it in that way, with what we had available, would have been a cappella and of a religious nature. It would have been very difficult to preserve a lot of indigenous African non-religious practices or non-Christian practices. I actually just did some reading on this, where some of our cultural expression that is merged together with the church, some of it has maintained some of the indigenous aspects, but not a lot. So I think that, again, this music has such an aura around it where so much has been preserved, passed on, and carried, shape-shift and transformed name-wise. But again, I like to refer to, I know this is the title of the book by W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk. I have heard people describe Black American sacred music as having that soul, the soul of the Black experience. And I really think that is so true. And so when we move into non-sacred musics that were originated by Black American folks, like blues, rock, country, jazz, we look at these forms and the ways that they're represented today. And I think, as you mentioned before, that it has inspired almost every form of American music. Giving that acknowledgement, as Dr. Phillips said, shows that we may have at one time been illiterate, but we were not ignorant. We've always been creators and collaborators and coming up with very creative works of art. And so one thing that I think is really cool that we can do nowadays is that we can put styles together. So for me, one thing I like to do is I like to merge, as I heard growing up, I like to merge the spiritual with a gospel jazz expression and interpretation, because those were all the parts of the casserole that I had when I attended my church. And so to me, they all go in sync, they're interlinked and interconnected. Although I think, as Dr. Phillips advocates, it's extremely important to know and be able to perform and express the spiritual set apart from those groups and recognize it and take a minute and step back and perform it in its authentic form. Very simple, unaccompanied, or with very, very simple, thin accompaniment. And I'm just commenting on how amazing I think it is that we can take all these styles that we contributed to or and originated and put the spiritual a bit in the middle of it, so it's still in there, but we've expanded and moved along as we do, as we continue to evolve and add more instruments and also get inspiration from other styles.
I'm sure there's a lot you're thinking of commenting on in what Monica said, Dr. Phillips.
Well, if you look at it in reality, many of the people who were blues performers, for example, Thomas A. Dorsey. They call him the father of gospel music, you know, his precious Lord. He was a piano player for Ma Rainey. Ma Rainey was a blues singer, and let me say this, a house of entertainment, is that proper to say? And the success of the blues singer when Thomas A. Dorsey came along was to get the people from the back to come to the front, because in the very back, they would have this corn whiskey, and they would have a little dipper, and it would be 15 cents if you were there. You want them to go a little further, it would be 25 cents. And then if you want to go even further to the stage, it would be 50 cents. And the blues singer had to be the one to bring them in, but the blues singer was the accompanist. What he or she would play would bring that person in. Then, of course, at the very front, you had them, the commercial women who wanted to apply their wares, so to speak. But the blues singer had to do this. But the piano player was the one who had to do it. Now, Thomas A. Dorsey, he had an epiphany after his wife died. And he decided to turn his music to the church. church in Chicago. And he incorporated many of the blues progressions. Of course, you know, with the spiritual, is based on the pentatonic scale, do, re, mi, sol, la. And he got things started. And the accompaniment with many gospel music is very, very important. Otherwise, it is not as effective. And then, of course, you have several people who started out as instrumentalists and singers who switched over. A good example is a woman named Sister Rosetta Tharpe. She sang with the Lucky Millinder Band. And she would play in the nightclubs on Saturday night and then go to the church on Sunday. So we are pretty flexible people.
I see that. And our music goes where we go.
Yes.
Earlier, you said that there are three categories of Black American sacred music, worship. Second is emotional support, and the third is signals for escape. And we're going to move on to another famous piece now, called Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child.
That fit into the second category.
Emotional support.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to say a quick word about that song. I listened to, growing up, those that knew that I also played saxophone would try to, you know, give me the music of other saxophonists to inspire me. And someone gave me the Kirk Whalum Gospel According to Jazz CD. Kirk Whalum is an amazing saxophonist. And on that CD, he incorporated some spirituals into jazz, into his performance. And so it was more of jazz gospel performance. But I'll never forget, I heard an interpretation of Sometimes I Feel Like a Motherless Child. And I believe it was done by him and his brother, who is a vocalist. And listening to them share the lines back and forth on the instrument versus the voice. And then, of course, they had the band backing them up. I mean, I never forgot that. And that's an inspiration that I didn't realize I was carrying around with me until I began preparing for this program. And I realized in talking with you that some of my ideas for arrangements were a bit different from what you might have had in mind. And it came to me how much influence the time that I grew up in and the musics that I was influenced by at that time, even within the religious sphere, how much impact that had on how I choose to arrange songs and how I choose to arrange the spirituals. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because, again, we are constantly evolving. And not only do we keep evolving, but the very similar needs that we had for the spirituals to be able to praise the Creator God, to be able to have emotional support for what we were going through. We may not have the exact same environment, but as we have evolved, our environment has evolved to where we still experience so many things that we need ways to express how those things impact us, the society that we live in. And so we need ways to be able to express how it makes us feel. We need ways to express how we intend to continue to be resilient as others were resilient before us. We need ways to express that we still have a belief in a faith and a being that is going to, that sees the value in us and that doesn't forsake us based on how others treat us. And we have that continued need to express to others that are going through the same thing that they're not alone. And so in that way, I still find that the three values and the three principles that those spirituals were based on, we've shape-shifted and included that into our music today, and we still use some of those same values, even though the music has evolved. And so I can find a lot of comfort in this song, even though I have a mother, and I have a couple mothers because I'm adopted. I have a mother, I understand what the song is saying, and I can feel the feeling of the person that's telling that story. Maybe not in the same way, but I feel like those emotions and those feelings carry on and that they're passed down, you know, to us throughout the generations. So I get a lot of support and comfort from this song, as well as I imagine you might.
We're going to hear Monica Washington Padula and Dr. Romeo Phillips on WMUK's Weekend. Let's hear it.
Thank you.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long ways from a home, a long ways from a home.